school, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm both honored to be here and actually particularly pleased to see Francis Gurry on the stage with us. The work that I'll be describing to you could not really have been done without a long-standing and very constructive engagement with WIPO, and in particular its information services that gave rise to the exceptional patent scope, which has informed much of our work. What I'll be describing is a new initiative that is basically launched today that summarizes much of the work and encapsulates much of the work we've done initially in the agricultural arena around mechanisms to maximize the number of people and the type of people that can solve problems in new ways themselves. What we're doing with the Initiative for Open Innovation is trying to learn from many of the previous examples of open source and open innovation to maximize the innovation system equitability. So let's imagine in the context of public policy that there are groups of questions that any policymaker and indeed any practitioner will wrestle with. As you come to this raft of questions, we must keep in mind that policy, public policy, in the absence of answers to these questions and all questions like it, will be potentially counterproductive. We must have an evidence-based policy or we will actually be in retrograde motion. So look at such questions as who has patented the rice genome and where, who controls the tools for agricultural biotechnology. What does this mean for researchers in the developing world and for food security? Who's reaping the benefits? What is going on in crop-based biofuels innovation? Who's controlling this technology? Unless a policymaker has at her or his hand the answers to these questions, the policy they articulate will be flawed. We need to have a mechanism by which these questions in agriculture, and indeed corresponding questions in other sectors of innovation, can be readily answered, readily modeled, and can inform thoughtful policy and practice. Consider in the environment, we've heard about issues of climate change, but what are the fundamental practical questions that we'd like to wrestle with? How important are emerging firms from China and India in the development of these new climate-friendly technologies? To what extent are the oil majors shifting their research into renewable energy? What opportunities for algal biofuels, and so on? And of course, in public health and medicine, critical issues that are enraging populations right and left that require evidence to answer. Where can one legally produce and export generic versions of patented medicines? Who are the main players developing the next generation of HIV/AIDS treatments, and where are they investing resources? What obstacles do patents present for rapid development and dissemination of vaccines for a flu pandemic? These and other types of questions are not academic, they are practical. They are not something that can be resolved with a white paper, a one-off. They are dynamic, evolving, and must empower everyday decisions. I'll now talk about a metaphor for how we can break this logjam. I call it mapmakers, mariners, shipwrights, and sailors. And with a few minutes of your indulgence, I'll describe where we are in the intellectual property world relative to where we were in the 15 and 1600s in the mercantile and maritime commerce world. When maps were originally developed, they were not predictive and instructive. They were whimsical and often cautionary. This early map depicted more than anything else the dangers, the problems, the mythical beast that would devour you out there. The detail in the map did not allow you to navigate, but it did warn you not to try. This was a critical feature of poor maps. Now, those poor maps did not empower mercantile progress. These did. We developed instruments, humankind have developed instruments that allowed us to measure accurately the truth, the nature of what is really there, not here there be dragons, but here there be ports, here there be reefs. These measurement tools were necessary to acquire the primary data that could inform human beings. Basically, without human beings to ask questions, how deep is the water, how close is the competition, and what is this silk worth, then trade would have been meaningless. In combining these, the data and the interpretation, we produced a fundamental sea change, if you will, in the way we approached interaction between peoples. Now, let's look at the limitations that that type of progress imposed, and can we learn from these? In maritime trade and commerce, when navigation was difficult and inaccurate, when many of the Manila galleons would sink on the way to the New World, what would happen? It would be so expensive and risky that the following thing would occur. Maritime trade and commerce then had little data. Did we know where the rocks were, where the continents were? very poor and outdated maps. Correspondingly, they were trade secrets and very tightly fought over trade secrets among the nations of Europe. Very poor navigation tools. A lodestone is not a very good tool compared to a GPS. The ships were fragile. They did not sail well. And there was a limited knowledge of the partners with whom you could trade. Now, that's going to sound very similar to what we face right now in innovation that is working through the intellectual property system. There is fragmented and very poor patent information, especially amongst the resource poor. There's little skilled interpretation available. There's lack of freedom to operate advice, lack of collaborative legal and normative instruments to decrease the costs and mitigate the risks. So when the voyage is expensive and risky, logically, only the highest margins and largest markets are well served. In the case of maritime trade, that caused usurious trade terms, low relevance to the weaker partner, and little reciprocity in trade. What a surprise that in innovation coming from science and technology, the same risks and lack of transparency cause only high-priced drugs and seeds to be focused on. Neglected diseases indeed remain neglected. Environmental degradation increases. And the most important is that the neglected innovators remain unengaged. Now let's go to the specifics. The work that we'd done starting out with our colleagues at WIPO some years ago to develop what has now become one of the more popular patent analysis facilities on the web, the Patent Lens. We aspire with this new initiative with funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates to go well beyond the era of vellum and parchment maps and into the land of informatics. The global patent data availability should be viewed as the minimum standard that we should aspire to. That's a baseline that we should have. And that's just all jurisdictions, full text in all languages as a uniform public resource, minimum. With the work that's ongoing at WIPO, I think we can be confident that that's within our grasp in the near future. But to this, we need much more than latitude and longitude. We need features. We need to know so much more about the innovation landscape. We need regulatory data. So in this work in the next year, we'll be adding such regulatory data to the patent corpus, including the Orange Book from pharmaceutical regulations and field trial data from U.S. Department of Agriculture and any other national authority. The scientific and technological literature is a resource of unprecedented beauty until you look at the patent literature. It seems that most public sector scientists never look at the patent literature for what it is. It is a staggering resource of enablement, but it is rarely viewed. In agreements we have with the Nature Publishing Group and with the NIH, which runs PubMed, we will now be making reciprocal links between patents and the published literature in science and technology, so that we can take inspiration from the public domain or limited domain literature and see where their counterparts are in patents and understand their relationship to each other. Similarly, we talk often about patents as tools for power and control, but do we know anything about that power and can policy be informed by that? It's interesting that if you look on the front page of a patent, you'll see the applicant data. It should be metadata rich with information. The name of Syngenta or Monsanto or Cambia may be listed on that as the applicant in a patent. But what is that organization? Does it include subsidiaries, affiliates? Who has licensed? What is the real pattern of ownership? What is the real pattern of authority and responsibility? The information is there in a scattered and fragmented way. We will be integrating into this cyber infrastructure such things as the SEC, Security and Exchange Commission, and every national counterpart for public business information, and the gray literature, rumors, publicly annotated thoughts. Legal status and family is critically important. Has the patent been issued? Most of them have not. Is it current? Most of them are not. Do we know that when you inspect the literature? No. Genes and compounds, what Michael was alluding to, the issues of DNA and pharmaceuticals, those are also disclosed in patents, but virtually no one can search them. We will be including these with our colleagues not only here at WIPO, but at Genbank, PubChem, and ChemBank, and many other public entities. Together, this forms what we call a cyber infrastructure. And it's a Web 2.0 cyber infrastructure. Now, that basically means that we're not pushing information. We are part of a network of ebbs and flows. The community, the base, the foundation, is a key part of this cyber infrastructure. Now, how can we inform policy based on practice? We must have detailed analysis of any given field. Let's take an example. We will be doing patent landscaping in influenza, in biofuels, vaccines. That patent landscaping will in turn inform policy that is specific to those activities, as policy should be. Now, these practice groups will not only inform the policy, but they will be informed by the public. Some years ago, as was alluded to by Shaquille and also by Mike, we started the biological open source movement and went through quite challenging processes to begin to take the metaphor of open source, which does indeed absolutely depend on intellectual property, into the world of the life sciences. And the lessons, very briefly, are we need vastly better patent intelligence and decision support to create a shared platform or to collaborate effectively. We need new transparency, metrics, and frameworks for the public agencies to incentivize and reward new approaches. We need legal and normative options beyond patent licenses and pools to cope with fragmentation of rights. We have to get beyond the questions because ultimately, even after answering the questions, we must act to do things, to create new value, new wealth creation opportunities, and bring in new innovators. To do this, we've also been developing new legal instruments in the last few years. After having gone through patent licensing regimes and materials transfer agreements, we realize they have shortcomings, which I don't have time to describe to you. We've developed a new legal instrument we call a Concord. Very briefly, the Concord is based on an open, stewarded, mutual non-assertion agreement, which is constrained on its field of use, and it is based on contracts, which don't suffer any of the constrictions and constraints that patent licenses and materials transfer agreements impose. I would give an example extremely briefly of this because I see the chairman is making eyes at me. A concordance for malaria. I've spent some time talking with one of my friends, Chris Elias, who runs an organization called PATH, and we speculated how could we develop a completely new approach to building a community to solve such a foundational problem that we all agree needs to be solved but is subject to a market failure. Imagine an institute with malaria gravitas and capability as a steward of a contract. Now imagine they offer a contract called a Concord to any party that agrees to the following things. They will not assert or allow to be asserted over other parties to the Concord any patented technology they have, acquire, control, over that particular field of activity. This is not a research activity. It's towards everything that could solve the problem of malaria non-prescriptively. Let's say universities join, because what do they lose? They're just agreeing not to assert. They're not granting licenses. They're not actually contributing to a pool. They just agree not to assert anything. Let's imagine several pharma companies join. They all say they can't make money with malaria. So they join, and they can, anyone.
Please, would you conclude? I'm sorry.
Yes.
You've exceeded a lot by a large
okay.
margin.
Thank then you. I refer you then to my published as of this afternoon presentation. And I will not continue there. I will simply say that the progress on the Initiative for Open Innovation is good, and we're making a lot of momentum now. There will be near-term outputs that are outlisted there, and I don't have time to cover, apparently. But these will all be done and are being done now, and I encourage you to look at the patent lens and monitor it for progress. We have an International Advisory Council convening almost exactly a month from now in Queensland, chaired by Dr. Sibusiso Sibisi, who is the president of CSIR South Africa, about 30 members funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Lemelson Foundation, Queensland University of Technology. Thank you.